Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse. Snacky Tunes.
Hello, welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm your host, Darren Bresnitz. A big shout out and thank you to everyone who signed up and is reading Snacky Tunes, the newsletter out on Substack, coming out every other Monday. It's been great to see all the positive responses, so we're super appreciative of that. If you want to hear the behind-the-scenes story or have any episodes featured, please do not hesitate to reach out. We are over the moon to welcome back one of our first guests, George Motes, who's coming back for a long overdue chat. George, aka the Burger Scholar, shares so many delicious tales from what he's been up to since, I would say, the last decade when he was on. He talks about his new book, The Great American Burger Book, the opening of his new restaurant in New York, Hamburger America, and how his TV show Burgerland still stands up today. Then we head into the archives when we had Brooklyn pop dance duo Crush Club on. They talked to us about how funk and Latin-style percussion influences their music, how they've had a strong following with popular singles like Louder and We Dance, and they get into depth about dance lyrics and the all-important bass bod. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy Snacky Tunes here on Heritage Radio Network.
Got lost in the darkest cloud. Yeah. I thought there was no way out. No, I almost lost control. I forgot what I was living for. But I still got my energy. And no music.
Thank you. come on, Chi-Chi. Chi-Chi, come on. The Crush Club.
George, it is my absolute pleasure to welcome you back to Snacky Tunes. You were on, and I had to look it up, episode 134 back in October of 2012. You were in the first couple of years. I know. And I got to say, I still think fondly about that conversation. And I'm not just saying it because I'm looking at you now, but I was like, man.
2012?
Yeah, 2012.
I can't even think back that far. I don't know.
I don't know,
where
man.
Where was that?
We were in Brooklyn. We were in the sheds. Yep. It was about the Food Film Festival, but you've done so much more since then. But how have you been? I mean, I've been following along with everything you've been up to, and we're going to get into some of that. How have you been?
I've been great. I've been great. Good to see your face.
It's really good to see your face.
But I can see your face. It's good to see you, bud.
Yeah. So we had you on, like I mentioned, to talk about the Food Film Festival, which was such a big movement and such a precursor of what was to come in sort of short film, food as the focus and storytelling and things like that. Like, no one really could foresee what was going to happen with social media, which is so much of what I think the Food Film Festival tapped into.
I appreciate that.
But since then, you've become like the preeminent burger expert in America, if not the world. When did that shift happen? How did you start moving from like the food film guy to like the number one burger man?
Well, the funny thing, we were just talking about this because the burger thing and the Food Film Festival thing actually happened at the same time.
That I do remember. But one started to eclipse the other a little bit.
It's true. One did start to eclipse the other one. Because they started to come together and then they kind of split apart.
Yeah.
This became enormous. We started selling out. Every event we did, we sold out immediately, which is great. It was a very exclusive event. I mean, you could only feed and show films to 300 people at a time and for five events in a row over 5 days. So it was fairly exclusive, but it took on a life of its own. But the hamburger thing became more hyper-focused. And I just became on me and less about the burger. It was weird because it became less about the burgers and, or maybe say equally so about me and my knowledge and what I knew. And then something very strange happened about 2018. I was approached by First We Feast, and they said, "We're looking for some. We need some information on hamburgers. We already have a hosted show called The Burger Show, and we need a. I hate to say it. We need an old sage, basically, to come in and sort of be our historical context to great hamburgers in America and the world." And I said, "Okay, fine. Thanks very much. Let me think about it." And I got back to them right away. They put me on one episode, and without telling me. It's a true story. I was on a plane to Brazil, and when the actual episode dropped on First We Feast, where I was featured as the – ready for this one? The actual title they gave me was The Burger Scholar.
I mean, that's pretty good.
It worked. No one told me that. And then I started getting emails and phone calls. Like, by the time I landed, I had like 20 emails about, who do you think you are? Well, I can't believe you're calling yourself the Burger Scholar. I didn't call myself the Burger Scholar.
It was Chris. It was all of them. Like, come on. I wouldn't do it. But now that it's out there – I guess I am the Burger Scholar. I'd love to not wear the crown, but if the crown's being put on my head.
Exactly. That's basically what I said. And it, I would say it kind of took off from there, that like sort of phase two of my hamburger life, because I think what happened was very simply, I picked up a whole new generation of fans. I have a generation of fans now that span. At one point it was like, basically like, you know, people look kind of like me, a little bit overweight, glasses, dudes. And then it just started to go into some women, actually, which is fascinating. And then also younger kids. I mean, I have fans that that now think I'm funny, but they're 14.
I mean, if I could ever be funny to teenagers, what a dream. That's the ultimate goal. You've always done this really great job of combining the media part with the food part and then the actual cooking and like the tactile tasting of it. Why was that dual, if not triple path of combining it all together, so important to you? How did you see that? Obviously, now looking back, that like full 360 immersive thing is a no-brainer in some ways, but you knew this 10 years ago, longer.
Yeah, I truly, all of us who worked in the Food Film Festival really believed in the multi-sensory experience that was food. I don't think people were not really talking about what it was like to experience food. I've always been fascinated with foodways, not just in the U.S., but all over the planet. And trying to figure out how those foodways became specific to that region or that type, that group, that population or whatever, mm-hmm. and how ingredients have shifted, you know, all the ways that, like, for example, pasta and you know, has gone all over the world, and where did it begin and where is it now? It's all very fascinating stuff for me. I love looking at foodways, and the best way to explore that kind of stuff are two ways, obviously. Well, three ways. One, to actually get out there and eat it and do it and find it.
Yeah.
If you don't have the option to do that, you watch a film and you learn from content. And this goes back to the beginning of the Food Film Fest. You'd watch something and you'd say to yourself, I wonder what that tastes like, or I wonder what it smells like, or how are they making it, or I never knew you could use that ingredient for that. And then while you're actually having that thought, and what we did at the Food Film Fest, obviously, was we gave you that experience right in your seat.
Yeah.
I think it was obviously fairly unique because at the time, I don't think Instagram existed when we
I mean, it was in its early days, but it wasn't, you know, it was like, oh, here's a sunset. I'm going to put a filter on it. And like, there we go. That's my post. Yeah. It's not like I'm going to try and scam a restaurant for food and I'm going to shoot a, you know, a sandwich and some chips or something like that.
Right. And stand on a chair with a big light and everything.
Oh, yeah. Now,
don't get me started.
Oh my God. We don't have enough. That's another podcast. So, you know, listen, I know you may have not written the title of Burger Scholar. And that was adorned on you. But you did write one of the great books on burgers called The Great American Burger Book. What made you want to get into writing a book about hamburgers? What do you think hadn't been said at that point that needed to be brought together through your perspective?
Well, first you made a film called Hamburger America. Mm-hmm. That was actually, I started production on that in 2001. Whoa. And we finished it.
Burger Odyssey.
Yeah, Burger Odyssey. So it was, it profiled eight different hamburger restaurants in America.
Mm-hmm.
It premiered in 2004 in Chicago. I'll never forget the MCA. I was just looking at photos of that just now.
Wow.
I was a baby. I'd had very dark hair and big, dark, bushy sideburns.
Sideburns look good, and the hair looks good. Look, I have no hair left, so like I'm
joking.
Yeah.
When the film came out, right away people started to ask my opinion of hamburgers, and I was saying, "No, I'm a filmmaker. I'm not a hamburger guy." And I said, "Well, you've been to these places." And someone asked me to roll my research into a book called Hamburger America, which came out in 2007, I think. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of the beginning of people taking me seriously, or me taking the burger seriously, and watching people take the burger as seriously as I did, and it just grew from that point on.
Yeah, it's been so interesting because you've been in the media food landscape, or even just being like so deep on even something that could be seen as esoteric as a burger.
Right.
And now it's like you have whole business models of restaurants.
This
is where we get our bread. This is where we get the cheese. This is the pedigree of the beef.
It's truly amazing.
It's truly amazing.
A turning point, though. I'll tell you what, there was a turning point.
Yeah, I was going to ask
you for sure. Yeah. I'll tell you what it was in 2010, I was asked to speak speak at the National Archives in Washington, D.C. About the history of the hamburger. And specifically, they wanted to show my film, Hamburger America, and bring it into the collection, a permanent collection at the archives, National Archives. So this is pretty interesting. So I got down to give my speech, and I thought, here I was always giving these rah, rah, rah speeches, like, this is why we need to save the American hamburger. And but I realized that when the guy who introduced me gave his introductory speech and to bring me on the stage, he was very – he basically took my whole speech that I had planned and talking about how – why we need to save something, you know, a food way – as important as the American hamburger. And I said, I just ripped it up and said, okay, my job is done here. And I realized at that point, everything had changed. Everything had switched at that point. Everything. It's pretty fascinating.
So having the book being lauded like that, how did you parlay that into your TV show, Burgerland? Because that is, as you mentioned and you alluded to before, yes, it's about the burgers. Yes, it's about the location. But you said it became a little bit more about me, which is, again, like you could find, no offense to you or anything, which like you could find a lot of people who know or at least pretend to even know burgers and go around to be a personality. How did you get the job? How did you fill that slot? How long did it take for you to feel like you really had become that scholar?
Become a scholar. I don't think I ever really realized it until the Burger Show came along and told me that I knew who I was, and I knew that I had some valuable information. I won't tell you who, but a lot of people in the industry who are big names, including, you know, not just people but also industry heavies, you know, big burger heavies, reached out to me for my opinion. I knew that at that point I was on my way to I really needed to make sure I boned up and study what was going on because people were asking my opinion. I mean, I was asked by a lot of writers, without giving names, TV celebrities who would ask me my opinion and say, can I please borrow your film or whatever? Like, can you please come and speak for me? Or I consulted for all the big guys without giving names again. I realized at that point that I definitely had an opinion that was worth it. That was good.
But then how does that become a TV show? Because I think a lot of people focus on a topic and think that they can make that jump, but that's not how it always happens.
It was a little strange the way it happened. The short story was that a friend of mine who was a producer in Hollywood, in LA, he said, I would like to make a pilot. I think you've got something here. I think you could make a great show. And I said, okay, fine. Let's try making a show. And we shot a pilot. We pitched it to a bunch of networks, and I think like 12 networks all said no. I said, okay, it's over. Don't worry about it. And I got a very bizarre phone call about 6 months after we sent our pitch tape in, and it was a producer from the Travel Channel saying, would you like to host a show for us? And I said, is the show about hamburgers? Because I don't know anything else. And they said, no, the show's about America. I said, I'm confused. Okay, how did you get my name? And they said, well, we found your pitch tape and we saw yours and we threw everything else in the garbage. We want you to host the show.
Wow.
So what's the show called? He said, it's called Made in America. I said, you'd be perfect for the job. I said, okay, I don't know the show. Oh, wait a minute, you mean the show with what the guy from Cheers? And I said, yeah, we're actually doing a reboot of the show. We'd like to have you host the show. I said, oh my God, I'm in, done, say no more. I said, but here's the deal though. I would like you to consider the Burger Show that I pitched you guys for in the first place six months ago. And they said, we'll make you a deal. You do one season of Made in America and then we'll shoot a real pilot for your show. And that's how it started. We did the full season of Made in America. The show got canceled. Not my fault.
Not your fault. No. Wasn't even your show.
Wasn't even my show to begin. We had a great time. It was a really good show. We ended up visiting 36 factories in 13 episodes. I had the greatest time. I've always wanted to go back and do that show somehow, but do it with hamburgers. With me and hamburgers and factories in America, it's fascinating. But then we made a double pilot It took off. It rated really, really well. They called me. I'll never forget. They called me they aired on Sunday of Labor Day weekend, something stupid like that. And it really did well. Surprisingly, they said it did not expect it to do well at all.
Oh, you love that. Hey, we thought this would tank. We do not believe in you. Really and much to our chagrin, here we are calling you.
Tuesday at 9 o'clock in the morning, my phone was going crazy. And they said, we need to do more episodes immediately. Get on the road. And so we did. And that's how it happened.
Amazing. I want to talk a little bit more about the series and then talk about you cooking burgers and about your book that's about to come out along with your restaurant. Here's a song from the archives on Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network.
I dream about you all the time. You're my be on my mind when time was turning, being tugged by the boat of the fragile mind. We hope we might make it out alive. Too late to tell the tale of aid. Our hands were washed and stained for aid. Are you who still gain for aid?
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We have hamburger expert, TV host, film festival curator, author, George Motes. And before we left, we're talking about the initial success and rolling out of your TV series, Burgerland. So the network had obviously slotted you into the show as talent for the other series, but this was really yours and your vision. Did you get to go to the places you wanted? Did you get to be you? Were you playing a character? Did you, you know, how much of it was the show you wanted to make?
It's funny. I would say 98% of it was the show I wanted to make, which, was pretty rare. Well, I'll tell you why. I'll tell you what happened was I had one of these the advice I give everybody who has to approach, a meeting room full of, television executives. The one advice I give everybody all the time is that when you walk into that room, it's your show. Don't forget that. And your opinions are actually more valuable than theirs. And I never thought that. I thought, oh, I'm just going to be this sort of puppet. That's okay. I want to be on television. Cool. And they're going to tell me what to do. But the minute I started to have an opinion, they started taking notes. And that's the shocking part. People don't expect that ever. They just assume like, oh, I'm just here to listen to the executives. I mean, I don't think it's like that with every network out there. I'm assuming Food Network has their own, very, very strong opinions. Yeah, we know they do. Everyone does. But if you voice an opinion, they listen to you. And believe it or not, the show that we've actually, the actual sizzle reel we made is almost identical to the show. Nothing really changed. They added one act to it, I think. And we added, obviously, the graphics and all the title treatment changed. Other than that, the show we wanted to make, we actually made, which I find fascinating. And one of the problems I had with Made in America originally on Travel Channel was that some factual stuff was getting kind of mixed up, and I would try to make it a point to say, hey, this is not 1927, 1923. And that's okay. We're already through the edit. And so I made sure that we did Burgerland. It was going to be factually perfect all the way through.
Well, especially that's the reputation as well. You know,
yeah, that's what I said to them. I said, you can't do this. The other thing that we changed about the show was that I sat down in a meeting room with all the production company at that point, and I said, I want to make this show a very specific way. I want you to think about No Reservations was doing really well.
Yeah.
And I said, it needs to feel very conversational. So I want to take the cameras and don't put them wide angle right in front of our faces. Get them back. Go across the room. Just pick me off across the room. Pick off the chef and the talent, whoever we're talking to at the counter, from across the room. So they don't know we're having this conversation. And of course, we ended up with a lot of great stuff. That was one thing I said to them. I said, the second thing I said, the food shots have to be amazing.
Yeah.
People have to want to eat their screen, period. And they said, well, you know, we only have an hour at the end of the day slotted for tabletop and food shots. Said, not enough. I would say the afternoon. I would shoot interviews in the morning, lunch, and food shots the afternoon. They are crazy.
I mean, but that's you know, again, what is now second nature, where you got to book out a couple of hours, have a setup, things like that, especially when you're shooting the same beauty in the grand scheme of things. You're shooting a burger every time, which to us, you're like, well, this has fried onions and this is a cheeseburger and this is a triple decker. And you're going like, these are all very different. To a lot of the times to people who are watching, it's like, this is the same. It's just a hamburger. I don't, you know,
right.
So you got to make people stand out.
You had to find a way to make the shot look great all the time. But also what happened was the more you shoot the same shot over and over again, and you start to explore, oh, I can probably do this as a different shot. This looks better. And you also I got the crew really into it. Like they actually got into it. Let's try this shot. Let's try coming overhead. We're zooming in. We're coming across on it. We had this like skate wheel dolly we picked up at one point. And it actually forced the crew to keep pushing further and think of different cool, fun food shots, and then get closer and closer and have fun with it.
Yeah. I mean, it was a great show. I remember when it came out, I loved it. And obviously it's not going on now. It got canceled at one point, which is never a great feeling, but that didn't keep you from being on screen. What made you want to stay on camera, and how did you chase that opportunity as well, even after the TV show went away?
Yeah, well, it went away because there was a big executive shift to Travel Channel. We tried to negotiate with them, and they basically cut my budget in half. And I said, we were going to come and ask for twice as much. And so they said, and then once we in the middle of negotiation, we were considering doing it for less money. But then the whole Travel Channel was absorbed by a larger company, and then everything went away. Which is, that's normal. That actually is very normal. I try to tell people also,
it's happening right now. The same changes in the industry are happening right now.
And there's no way to control it. All you have to just do is you have to prepare yourself for, you know, if I'm not invested, I'm freelance. So I'm like, hey, you know, I'm good like this.
Well, that's the same advice when I give people who are getting into it. I go, people are like, oh, we got all this great stuff. We're going to save it for season two. And I was like, no, you do the best season for season one, because you never know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
You put it all on the court. You leave it all out there. And that way, when you look back and you go like, we didn't hold back, then you go, there's nothing else we could have done.
I literally did the show I wanted to do. And I look back and I say, you know, I like this show a lot. I mean, there's some stuff I would have changed, but, you know, again, at that point, it was so close. It was so close to what it was our vision. I mean, honestly, if you look at that, it really was our vision. It was kind of silly. It was very, very factual and full of information. And the shots were amazing. And also, you could see from the show, we went everywhere.
America.
We could have done. Yeah.
Look, I've done travel shows where you're like, cool, three LA episodes? And you're like, yeah. Don't worry about it. All right. So you're counting Brooklyn and Manhattan as two different cities. Okay. Right. Okay.
So the production company was they're very smart about doing that. It has to have great production value. Let's get out there and do a show, a real show.
But so what kept you in front of camera? Because it's easy to be like, I did my show. I did, you know, I had this little First We Feast thing and I'm good. I want to focus on other things.
Well, I had a little bit of a dip there. We tried to – so at one point, I was a pariah. I mean, nobody wanted me to host their show on another network because I was already – I was old news from Travel Channel. Sure, I became old news like overnight. It was really bizarre. It was a horrible – that was a horrible feeling. I did nothing to deserve it. I was just a product of, you know, of what was this shift going on at Travel Channel. But – a couple of years went by and I kind of forgot about it. I just said, I'm okay doing what I'm doing. I was still filming. Yeah. I was a director of photography for 28 years of my life. And I was still doing that. So I was fine. I was totally happy. But then my agent came to me. This is kind of where it all got sort of ramp up. And she said, my lit agent, she said, you should think about doing a cookbook. I was like, a cookbook? Mm. Come on. And that really put me in a whole different place. A really different place. I mean, that when the cookbook came out, we did a book tour, and that's where I got back on camera again because
I remember the tour.
The first stop was in Seattle. We went to Fox. No, it's the Fox affiliate. I forgot what it's called now, but the Fox affiliate in Seattle. Mm-hmm. It was a live morning show with 200 people in the audience. It was hilarious because they said, "Okay, could you make a burger?" And talk about it and talk to the host at the same time in front of an audience, you have 7 minutes.
So, 7 minutes?
That was the segment.
So no, that's a lifetime for a morning cook show. It's normally like they give you 3 minutes and you've got to move through like 8 recipes.
Well, the question was, yeah, exactly. So I had to, what burger can you make and talk about at the same time in 7 minutes? The onion burger. How about the fried onion burger?
Sure.
I kind of pulled it out of my ear. And I said, oh, how about let's do this? And then I looked it up in my own book and I said, oh, yeah, it's only got 5 ingredients. I could probably pull this off.
I think I have a recipe on that. I think I have a good story.
Yeah. And that became the burger that I'm now associated with from that moment. It's called King. Fox. It was called King 5 was the morning show.
Sure. Sure.
And it was great. Great morning. It was one of those, like the classic like Seattle morning show with an audience, and nailed it. I was shocked at how good the burger tasted. I even like at one point, you could see me reach out and grab the burger from the host when she goes, this is really good. Oh, let me try that.
Yeah. I mean, you speak on a really good lesson is that this is all cyclical and it all is experience and nothing's wasted. And there are some really low points, especially if you want to be in this game. But now that you've sort of refound your footing and now that you've, let's just say you've aged into the scholar part of it from that point, you know, you have another book coming out and you have a restaurant that's about to open its doors. Yes. Where do you feel now about both those projects and how do you feel about sort of finding this second or even third act?
When the cookbook came out, the next thing that happened was very interesting. I started getting people reaching out to me from all around the world. I mean, other countries, Argentina, Brazil, Japan, France, Sweden, big, heavy, like burger countries, countries that absolutely love American burger culture. That was the next big thing that happened because I started getting asked to come and show up with some of these restaurants and countries and cooking school. I got invited to a cooking school in Sao Paulo. I got invited to a huge event in Japan. I've cooked at restaurants all over the world now, and I've given instruction. I get paid to give instruction on what is an American hamburger.
Wow.
And what's happened is at one point I did an event in Sao Paulo with 120 people in the audience. They paid a fair amount of money to actually be in the audience and listen to me talk about like where the best cut of meat is for hamburgers.
Sure, sure.
A PowerPoint presentation with the headset on and everything. And I did an overhead, cooking demo for the audience. And I asked who in the audience, you know, had a restaurant, and it was almost 80%, 85% of the rest of the audience that was listening to me. They already had their own restaurants going, and they came up to me and thanked me. One girl, true story, she came up crying and she said, "It's because of you. You saved my life." I said, "I didn't do anything. I just talked about hamburgers." Said, No, you saved my life. You gave me the inspiration to open a restaurant in Rio, and now my life is much better. And I'm still to this day. That was probably 7-8 years ago. I'm still hearing these stories, and I find it fascinating. I didn't do anything. I just offered you the window into my world. Mm-hmm, and I said, some people really do take it very seriously, which is good. So that was the next big phase to watch the burger sort of explode around the world.
Yeah.
Now it's coming back on us. So then it's nice to see people make burgers and not credit me, but at least be thankful the fact that they discovered this, you know, very niche world of hamburgers because of me. So that was the next big one. That was my next phase. And that's sort of when the Burger Scholar thing came around.
Yeah. And then parlaying that into another book, or the new book is interesting because people go like, oh, we'll just, you know, we'll do a reissue or we'll get this out of things like that. And so, and I know that the new book is dipping into the old book a little bit, but it's great to see that you've been able to update it and say that there's more to say about the burger. We're not just going to run it back. Like there's new things to share, partially in some crazy way of what the groundwork you laid and then you helped inspire this next generation. And now they're like, there's new things to say about burger because of what people took from you teaching them or at least looking for your guidance.
Yeah, we have now an international section to the book, which I had to fight for. The publisher couldn't quite figure out, my editor couldn't figure out like why I wanted to do an international section. It's called Hamburger America. It's called The Great American Burger Book. I'd say, but yes, but we discovered what we've,
diaspora.
We've been exploring the diaspora. We've been exploring how the hamburger has you know gone out into the world. It came from Germany technically. Came to America, it became this thing in America, but it went back out into the world as an American hamburger. And that's fascinating to me, absolutely fascinating. And I've been all over the world. I've been a lot of places to see that actually happen and see how they've translated it. So it made sense to actually have you know a section or chapter of the book devoted to international burgers. So
now,
it has changed. That's the good news about the book. The book has 27 new recipes in it, but they're all based on you know historically significant hamburgers.
Now, with the new restaurant opening, can people expect to taste some of these burgers at the restaurant, or is it a different focus?
Hang on one second, I have to cough. Sorry about that.
No problem.
Yes, the answer is definitive yes. The way it's going to work in the restaurant, there's basically three burgers on the menu. There's the burger that I've been making a lot called you know, the Oklahoma Fried Onion Burger will be on the menu, obviously, for sure.
Which I love. I love that because it's like, this is the burger I'm known for. This is the burger that people want. I'm going to sell this burger. It's not a zag. It's not like like I'll do this once a month. They're like, no, this is the business.
Yeah. I've probably made 30,000 burgers in the last 4 years. I've probably made 30,000 fried onion burgers in the last 4 years alone. Mm-hmm. Me personally, it's been insane. But you know, people like them, so I make them. The second burger on the menu, I'm just going to make a classic smash. Even I get a little bored sometimes of the onion burger. I want something different. But classic smash is going to be again historically significant, historically accurate. Where it's going to be a smash flat patty with a good crispy edge on it, with some chopped onion, mustard, and pickle, and that's it on a toasted bun. That's number two. The third burger is going to be a rotating monthly special where I bring in one of my hamburger heroes from around the country or around the world, and we make their burger side by side at my front-facing griddle in the restaurant to you know PR and fans and everything. And then we keep that burger on the menu for the month. And it could be the green chili cheeseburger from New Mexico. It could be the olive burger from Michigan. I have the first 2 years already figured out.
Amazing. So, but I gotta imagine there's gonna be a secret menu as well.
Yes, there's definitely gonna be a secret menu. Shh, don't tell anybody.
I won't tell anybody.
The secret menu is actually, in a way, my son and I figured it out. The secret menu is actually larger, I think, than the full menu.
Of course, that's the way it's gotta be.
We're doing this thing where we're saying, like, hey, if you can, we have a bowl of chili, obviously, we have a bowl of chili on the menu. And if you, you know, do the math, obviously, you think, oh, they have chili, they have cheeseburgers. I'd like a chili cheeseburger, and it'll be on the menu. But it won't be on the written menu, but it'll be in the computer if you know how to ask for it.
If you know how to ask for it. I mean, you know, there's this whole thing going on about, I don't want to say nostalgia, but like this idea of like diner and community. And, you know, I know that you mentioned that there won't be music during the day, so people can really hear the sound of the space. And people are really drawn to that. What makes you want to lean into that sort of era or that feeling of a restaurant and cooking?
It's a very simple answer, is that every restaurant I've been to that is an authentic hamburger restaurant, I get a good feeling. I walk in and I have a great feeling, and it makes me so happy to be in some of these places. And it's the conversations you have with people sometimes. It's the opposite of the food, the smells, the sounds, what it looks like. But it's just the overall feeling. It's kind of like, you know, it's hard to explain. Like if you try to, like if you go to the islands, you have a, you know, you have a, like a tropical drink on the beach, you know. It always tastes better for some reason on the beach with the salt and salty air and the warm temperatures than when you try to make it, you know, at home in your kitchen. It never, it could be the same exact ingredients, just never tastes the same. In fact, I just went on vacation to Turks and Caicos, and we got back from vacation. I brought with me the rum, and I brought the ginger beer. It was the same damn drink, and it didn't taste the same. Just didn't taste the same. So to me, it's like you have to be in these spaces, and I'm trying to create a space that is experiential, that when you walk into the restaurant, you right away you think to yourself, oh, this is familiar. I feel comfortable. I'm ready to eat. This is going to be awesome.
Yeah. Now, look, I'd be remiss because I know that we met in Brooklyn and now I'm out in LA, and I've seen you post a lot about the Apple Pan. And I'm not going to put you on the spot to be like, what is your favorite? What's the best? Because each, what I like about the way that you treat burgers is like each one has its own merits. But like, what I do respect about you is that you have not been like, the LA burger scene is not as good as the New York burger scene or things like that. When you crave a burger, if you could go anywhere right now, we'll take just this moment.
Ooh.
What city, where would you go? Where would you have the burger right now?
I can't. I don't play favorites. I can't do that.
I'm not saying favorites. I'm just saying in this moment during this conversation, if you could go have a burger, because it might change in the next hour.
Well, to me, my favorite burger that's the closest to me is the one I want to have.
Sure.
Okay. So that's usually the way I play that one. I'd love to go down to Joe Jr. and get a burger, you know, on Third Avenue. They have a great classic banging burger. It's so good. But it's basic, nothing to it. It's just beef on a bun pretty much with a slab of cheese. So it's hard. I can't play that. I'd love to.
All right.
There are some good burgers. LA's got a lot going on. LA has a weird like cutthroat thing going on right now.
I know.
Everyone's got to cool it out there. Woo,
I know. It's like the smash burger scene is so competitive here.
So competitive.
And it's like
and everyone's talking crap at each other. So they're all smack talk. What's going on?
I know.
We don't have that here.
No, well, because it's just there's burger saturation. I mean, I'll say it. I'm not going to go on the record. I know which one is my favorite, but it's something where I'm like, I won't even say it out in public because it's too competitive. Well, listen, George,
I won't say it either.
Yeah. I cannot thank you enough for coming back on. Hopefully, next time I have you back on, it won't be 11 years.
It's amazing.
We'll try and fit you in before then. But listen, shout out the book, shout out the restaurant, shout out where people can follow along with your adventures.
The next book is May 9th, coming up soon. It's the Great American Burger Book. It's the cookbook, but version 2. The restaurant opens hopefully in July. That's the plan right now. We'll see. We do have to get it open by July. That's the next big one. And beyond that, I don't know. I mean, we're about to greenlight the next Hamburger America book, which should be fun.
Just wow. So you know. And name of the restaurant for those who missed it?
Name of the restaurant is Hamburger America.
There you go. Makes it super easy. And if they want to follow along with your burger adventures, where can they go?
Definitely at Moats Burger on Instagram. M-O-T-Z Burger.
Amazing. Well, George, thank you so much. And thank you to your team for helping set this up as well. I'm so happy they reached out. It was great to see your name come through. We have a song from the archives and a live performance here on Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network.
Pretend you need company. We belong. catch a fire. We belong in the wake of desire. We belong in the far apart. We belong, but we fall apart. So hold my heart, I know you've been lonely. So hold my heart, I know you can hear me. I'll leave a trail so you can follow. I'll leave a trail so you never get lost. Oh. And you need company. We belong in the wreckage of fire. We belong in the wake of desire. We belong, but we're far apart. We belong, but we fall apart. So hold my heart, I know you've been lonely. So hold my heart, I know you can hear me. I'll leave a trail so you can follow. I'll leave a trail so you never get lost. Oh, we belong.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2-Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio.
Welcome back. Crush Club. Hey. Live in studio, TC and Leshev.
Hello. Yay! you're the only one. It's kind of a name, Leshev.
Yeah.
That's been around for a while. And sometimes, you know, you pick a name for yourself and you're like, man, that's like goofy. You know, after it's like a word that you just say over and over and over again. And after a while, it doesn't mean anything to you. And so I'm so glad you said it. And you said it right. And it's just nice.
Well, we've known each other for a long time.
I know.
So
yeah. Lots of emails.
You know, actually.
Well, I mean, prior to Crush Club.
Yeah.
Sweaty house parties in Brooklyn with Alex Pasternak of
Y'all
Lemonade.
Y'all dated, huh?
Well, yeah. I'm old. Well, the sun's still up. And we're listening to funk.
Hey. Yeah.
And disco and grooves.
Yeah.
I just texted my brother, this sounds like stuff we listened to when we were out.
Yeah. Right.
Which is great.
Feels right. I'd say definitely one of the motivating factors of Crush Club is like, that's what you want. Just do that.
Yeah.
I'm not like, I'd say we're not really going head to head with FKA Twigs on this project. We're having like a really amazing funk time.
I remember
all smiles.
I remember when I was at the end of DJing. It was when, like, you know,
And you're still, you're DJing right now.
Kind of. Okay, yeah. Like 4x4 right. And heavy bass is coming out. Right, and I was like, I'm going to have to stop because I just don't like this. And no one wants to hear the music I like anymore. So I guess I'm done. And there are some people who are just like, you know, DJ with the times. And
right. Yeah.
So it's like, you can always tell when people like, because I mean, watching you two perform, it's like, it could be 2 or 200 or 2,000. And I'm totally pretty sure it's the same performance,
which means
that you love it.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Deep
in the
core. This,
if it's, you know, 100 BC, this is the same. Even if we went back in time.
Back in time. Well, probably less amplified.
More just
no, we find the Colosseum.
Yeah.
Sound bounces off the wall.
It really does. There are a few words that I continue to see how Crush Club is defined. Bold, sexy, reckless, instincts, body, anticipation. Mm-hmm.
That just came from the chef's tender.
Movement.
movement.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
no, that's
but I can say it because... You know, you move, but you were giving great bass face and great bass body, which I think is a new era. What is it to be able to embody those words and kind of like, how does it take your music to kind of like both from the intangible and the tangible parts of words and then a feeling?
That's such a good question. Let me just answer for you.
Sure.
No, I'm just... to me, it's like, you know, you go through music, you learn all this garbage. I studied so much shit, and especially this project, like music, so much of it is just magical and makes you move in a way. And most people don't know, like, that's an A or that's a B. And to think about it is kind of dumb, too, you know? So this is more like everything goes in, you learn all your stuff, and then just do it, whatever feels good at the time. And you'll know, like, it's not just dancing. I can't sing very well at all, but I do the like Oscar Peterson. I don't know if you ever listen to Oscar Peterson. It's like, he's a jazz piano player, and he sings along with his piano, and he sings all crazy. So it's like, it's this most unbelievable piano solo you've ever heard. And he's going like, so I'm doing that also.
So you're like, backup yelling.
I'm backup yelling. I'm bass facing. I'm
body bassing.
Body bassing.
That's a lot. And you're just singing, huh?
I'm
get
just
to work.
Singing,
yeah.
Know?
Yeah.
I'm just grooving.
5 checks for me. 1 for him.
10 for me.
Yeah.
And when you're making this music, you know, it's so easy for the lyrics to kind of be throwaway or just kind of repetition. How do you match it? And, you know, what are you saying within the music that you know, compliments the backup yelling?
We spend time on our lyrics.
Obviously. No, it's very obvious.
That was a compliment. I know. Yes, yeah. Thank you so much.
That might have not come out as a compliment, but it was.
Right.
I think we know that it could easily turn into that. And so we try to be at least a little real and smart with the lyrics. And then usually, you know, I've had a fun night and I come in and I'm just speaking gibberish, and then Cheever just turns it into English. Yeah, very helpful.
You know, it's one of the, we have one song that never saw the light of day that's called Marshmallow. I shouldn't even give it away because someone's going to just steal it and make it a song. They owe us money already. And it was late in Paris, and our friend who's at the time, pretty ESL guy from Brussels, and we were like, get messed up, and we're like, let's go just jam, let's go make a beat. So you make a beat that's really slow and drunk, and the hook just goes marshmallow, marshmallow, marshmallow,
so nice,
so nice. And it was the fucking jam, like, it was really good.
Yeah,
so it's maybe not out yet. Coming.
You just sang the chorus, and then I'm back in.
Sense for
someone.
Someone's gonna use it. Yeah.
Everyone loves marshmallows.
Can we hear a song?
A song?
Oh, please. Yeah, yeah.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, let's do a song.
What are you gonna play for us first?
We dance.
Which I don't know if we're gonna play later. There's also the remix of this song that's currently storming up the charts. BBC World 1, Australia.
Yeah, super mini remix.
Thank you, Ramon.
Ramon,
so good.
Lopez.
Here we go. Crush Club Live on Snacky Tunes.
Like turned around. Got lost in the darkest cloud. I felt there was no way out. No, I almost lost control. I forgot what I was living for. But I still got my energy. And the music gives me
talk about the concept of a super mini remix, because I've never come across that before. So what is a super mini remix, and how much does it differentiate from the original before it goes into a super remix or a mini remix? Please educate.
Oh, this is I wish it was something that we came up. It was actually just somebody's DJ name. Yeah. But I'm, you know, okay, on that note, we have done a super mini, we've done like super mini EP, like where it just has like 2 seconds of every song, and it's so disorienting, but that's the advertisement for the EP. Anyway, yeah, this guy Ramon, forgot his last name.
Lopez.
Ramon Lopez.
Yeah.
Australian guy, hit us up randomly, found the song, you know, please let me remix, and we send him samples. Of course, you know, if anyone,
what's crazy is that,
like that
he was really eager, and I think like now today when someone's really eager, you kind of like think, what's up with this person, which is pretty screwed
it's
up.
It's really cynical, but yeah, I mean, it's but like sad. I know it's because right. Before you're just like, oh, we're collaborating,
yeah,
but now you're like, What's the angle here?
Yeah.
What's the game, guy?
Are you a real person? Like, are yes. you like a 14-year-old? But
is this just some like Russian
is this,
bot?
Is this Leshev just like building fucking, up confidence?
Yeah.
I sent this message to myself 5 years ago. So at the time, I'd be like, yeah, someone's listening. Love it.
But it turns out, like, refreshingly, he happens to be someone who just likes music and reaches out to people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he had like a remix like on the Billboard US dance chart. Like, he's like killing it. And he's just super eager and like amazing.
When we did remixes and like a million lifetimes ago, right. The last message I sent on MySpace was to Licky Lee to be like, I'm a really big fan. Can you send me the stems for a little bit? And she did. Like amazing. Right before. And I was right. like when you used to be able to be like, hey, I really like this. Can we remix it? And she's like, yeah, here you go. Like, that was an earnest time.
Totally.
Yeah. That is a long time right. ago.
Yeah.
Now it's like someone writes to you like, are you going to hack me? And is this a phishing scam?
Yeah. Are you just going to release the song like yeah. before yeah. it's out?
Right. And are you going to like take credit for it and then have to be like, no, that's ours.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. It's so dark. Do it people is. Do that? Actually, have you heard that someone is like, hey, let me remix this. And they just release it and be like, I wrote this song. That would be
that's
so
a great
that,
idea.
Yeah. Oh, how do we write this album?
We got to
we'll
go.
Never tell. We'll never tell.
Yeah.
Can we hear another song?
Yes.
Please.
What are you yes. going to play for us this time?
What do you want to do, Chi-Chi?
Let's do Trust.
Trust.
Yes.
Yes.
What everyone needs a little bit more of.
This is the gayest perfect. Crush Club song what, to date.
To date. Yeah. What makes it the gayest Crush Club song?
It just feels like, you know, like dark club, like
does that
sexy.
Equal gay?
It equals gay. I mean, have you been to a straight... I mean, yeah.
Sorry, I've been everywhere.
It makes me feel like I'm like in a back room,
yes.
you know, getting my dick sucked.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Here we go on Snacky Tunes.
Sloppy.
Trust.
About all the things I want, all the things you're not willing to.
You have a DJ residency at Club Coming.
Something sad has happened.
What has happened?
So I guess like their neighbors or something happened where...
This is a classic New York tale.
Yeah, it's like the cabaret license thing, only it's like the performance license thing. And someone brought it to like the city's attention that they didn't have a license for DJs or live performances. And so for the time being, they are shut down just for live stuff. They're still open, but yeah, any DJ or like live show nights have been indefinitely postponed.
That said, the residency there has been so fun.
Yeah. For the uninitiated,
yes,
and my parents,
yeah,
yes.
What is Club Coming?
Club Coming is Eastern Bloc back. It's Eastern Bloc 2.0. So Eastern Bloc was a gay bar in the East Village that went off when I was in college. Super sexy, fun, you know, stripper poles, go-go dancers. And then it kind of got lame. And then
As things do. Which is fine.
And they were going to shut down. But then Alan Cumming bought it and then turned it into Club Cumming.
Which originated from his dressing room when he was on Broadway. He used to turn it into Club Cumming and made a little sign for it. And that's where it started.
Is that true?
That is very true.
Ah, yes.
I'm just here to
fill in. Was that during Cabaret?
Yes. I'm just here to fill in the facts.
So
it's like he would invite people back and then that was Club Cumming and someone made a sign and then... like Cabaret closed and they're like, let's keep this going. And that's where the idea originated from.
Amazing. Yeah. I mean, I love Alan Cumming. He's the best.
Also, like the only way you could get away with a ton of press with that name and be like, yeah, well, that's his last name.
Yeah. Say what you will.
Say what you will. I don't know what you're saying, but that's his last name.
Just come
inside. I think a lot of people inside are taking it for face value.
Yeah. You mean on the face value?
On the face
value. Yes, all over the face, in the mouth.
But I mean, that is the thing about New York where it is like something is so good and a lot of people have a good time. And then there's one, I won't name the bar, but it's a well-known story about this bar that used to have this like ex-DIY punk rock kid turned lawyer who then systematically got them to roll back their hours. Yeah. And it's like one person who moved in above a bar and then was upset that they moved in above a bar and then like kind of ruined it for everyone else.
Yeah. And I think that's exactly what's going on here.
It's so crazy to me when people move to a city into a musical neighborhood and then
a young
expect
neighborhood
that it'll be nice and quiet for them.
Right.
Yeah, I don't understand.
It will be in 7 years. Just spend the time.
I feel that there's a social contract that you enter by coming, especially to New York. I mean, to other people, but by coming to New York, like, oh, it's loud. How are you surprised? Like, what did you actually want? What did you want out of this city?
Right.
Right.
And then it's like, oh, here's a lot of people, and a lot of people who can be marginalized or not celebrated or pushing quarter, who are just like living their lives. Right. And like, you know what? I don't like this. This represents everything I don't like, so I'm going to stop this.
Right. Yeah.
I wonder if Alan Cumming is going to go to court over this.
It's paperwork that we like missed, and like it'll be solved in 10 days, or like 2 weeks. And
or
you
like
know what?
2 years.
The way they make shit happen, I kind of believe them. And Alan Cumming is kind of like.
He's
like, you know, a god in New York, and I feel like he's gonna make it happen. And they made a good point that's like, this is a cultural hub. Yeah. Like, if you shut this down, you're like silencing people.
Yeah.
And I think that's true.
And I don't disagree with it. I mean, honestly, it's like that's where cabaret laws came from. It was to stop black people from dancing. I mean, it's like full stop. That's what it is.
Yeah.
I mean, like look at all these people who are different, having a good time. Like, we can't do racist stuff, so we'll be like, oh, shut it down. But like, I mean, we all went out. Like, we spent our entire 20s or 30s dancing. No one came and stopped it. That law got repealed 6 months ago.
Right.
It wasn't our parties that were getting shut down.
I was so confused when I heard it was still a law.
Right.
Because I was
It was there for the use of that or for things like things like this. It's interesting because New York is starting a nightlife task force too. Like, and they've shown that like nightlife and this type of culture actually benefits the city en masse. It like... does it on whole, and it shows like it brings people, it brings ideas together, it like breaks down barriers. So then to do this for that's super public too.
Yeah.
Huh. Did they shame who the neighbor is?
You know, I think I might, I don't know if I'm making the neighbor up, but it felt like someone made it like known to the powers that be that, that this was happening, and then they got shut down. Like, so I'm sure no one that actually goes to that bar, like, you know, yeah. or works at that bar or like is around that bar, like would ever bring attention to this. So
unless someone got bounced, like, okay, fine. They got,
I'm sure it's the person that pays $4,000 for the one bedroom apartment right. above the bar
or
who
someone,
wanted Eastern Block to close and helped it close.
Or someone got drunk and was like, I'll show them. And like drunk child 311 and we're like, who did I call right. last night? Oh my God. I can't believe this is happening. Who would do this?
I'm sorry, Amanda Lepore.
Sorry. No, I want to make sure you have an upcoming EP May.
Yes.
May-ish?
It's an ish.
An ish.
Yeah.
Sometime this year-ish.
Yeah, definitely.
What can we expect on the upcoming EP?
You'll hear two of these songs that we're playing today.
Okay.
We Dance and Trust. Three more unbelievable perfect songs.
Yes. With non-standard lyrics that will touch the soul, but also shoot from the hip.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. You think after.
Yes. When you're humming it in the shower, you go, yeah. I do feel that way. And I do want to be free. I do want to be free.
You know what? I like it. I don't take it for granted.
I don't.
I like freedom.
So this year-ish, stay tuned.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I want to make sure we have time for one more song. Where can people find you? Listen to your mini mix that is super mini
super mix.
Climbing up the charts. Yeah. Where can people find you?
Storming up the charts right now.
So the super mini remix will be out in the next couple weeks on Tinted Records, which is an Australian dance label. And then the rest of our stuff that's released is on Spotify, SoundCloud, you know, YouTube.
It's a miracle. If you actually look up Crush Club, vowels in, you'll find us.
You will also find the like 2008 teenage nightclub.
Yeah, yeah. It's so cool.
Where I was like, what I was doing, I was like, oh, okay. So I found a very certain amount of time in New York and Crush Club.
It's cool.
We're going to leave it on that.
Yeah, yeah.
What's the name of the last song you're going to play for us?
It's the first
song
we made. Yeah,
it's the
first
song. Get Me Off.
Yeah, first song we made. And it was a real great, like, you know, sometimes you make a tune, received well, everyone's like, yes, energy's right. And this is the whole project just kickstarted. It was felt great. And that it was a reason for everything.
Perfect. Well, thanks for listening this week. We appreciate you coming by. Thanks for letting me harass you for a year to come on the show. When the time is right, the time is right.
Yes. You know?
Shout out to everyone. Thanks for tuning in this week. We will be back next week with a new episode of Snacky Tunes. Take it away.
Cause you're never say never, we're closer than ever. Made for each other, and you know it's true.
Snacky Tunes is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaili, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.
Subscribe.